Greetings once again, America. My name is Doug McBurney, and you may have heard the news, but stand by now for the worldview. It is the Weekly Worldview, and I am your host, joined in studio this week by my extremely attractive audio engineer here on April 27th, 2014. And I woke up this morning thinking back to sixth grade when my sixth grade civics teacher had us all calculate how old we would be in 2000. And I was going to be 32, and I remember thinking, wow, I'm going to be old come 2000. Well, here we are, 2014. And yes, today, April 27th, is my birthday. Today's not an especially big birthday. It's not one of those big ones. It's not like 21 or 30 or 40 or 50 or 60. It's not really a big one or a special one or anything. It's just another one. And the advantage we all have these days is even when it's not a very special birthday, we get hundreds of Facebook reminders that we're a year older. Thank you all very much out there. I so much appreciate your well wishes. And I actually do, but it's a little depressing to get reminded 175 times before lunch that you're just another year older and it's not really even that special of a birthday. Yeah, okay. I did have one friend who actually sent me a card in the mail. Now that I really appreciated. That was old school. So, but thank you all out there, and yes, I am older. And if you want to figure out how old, you got to go back and do the math from my sixth grade class. Because I don't want to tell everybody how old I am. All right, now, let's move into... Well, first, I want to congratulate the South Korean Prime Minister. I want to congratulate him for having any scruples at all. Because the South Korean Prime Minister resigned this past week over his government's handling of the ferry disaster over there. And I just thought that that was the decent thing to do. So maybe if we want decent politicians, we have to move to South Korea. Nobody in the United States has resigned or been fired in I can't remember how long. Oh, what's her name? Didn't someone just resign? The witch who was in charge of the Health and Human Services? I can't remember her name, but she allegedly resigned, but we know that she's just moving on up to the east side to a deluxe apartment in the sky via the Democrat National Committee and the Obama machine, the Chicago machine. So over here, even when someone resigns, they don't really resign. In South Korea, the prime minister resigned in shame and tears over his government's mishandling of the disaster. And it was just a breath of fresh air to see somebody actually resign. That's all. Okay, yeah, my standards aren't that high anymore. Well, best you can hope for. All right. Now, let's go to our Northern Observer sent an email in regards to the story last week we did about Chelsea's announcement. You all remember that Chelsea Clinton announced that she was pregnant last week. And all the media was celebratory in their coverage of the Chelsea pregnancy. Our Northern Observer from somewhere in Alaska says, Doug, I just want to add my congratulations to Bill and Hillary on their daughter's big announcement last week that she is now with a blob of tissue. It was reported, Doug, that when Bill and Hillary saw the ultrasound together, Hillary turned to Bill and said, oh, look, honey, it's a grand blobby. It's the blob of tissue. Anyway, so I thought that was pretty funny. That's from our Northern Observer up there in Alaska. He also wrote a letter to the newspaper there in Anchorage, I think. Fairbanks, Anchorage, I don't know. He went on a rant about some local politicians. That's not going to make the show, but it was very well done. And our Northern Observer is very skilled indeed. We move now to the Bad Religion file. Immediately, right out of the chute, we're in the Bad Religion file. It's about the Vatican and Barack Obama. Question is, which one is a worse religion? No, I'm just kidding. All my Catholic brothers and sisters out there, please don't get upset with me. Vatican City from WorldNet Daily. At the Vatican canonization ceremonies for Pope John Paul XXIII and Pope John Paul II this Sunday, today, as a matter of fact, the unspoken issue dividing the Roman Catholic Church and the White House is President Obama's determination to force faith-based groups to pay for abortions and contraception as part of Obamacare. You remember, folks, just a couple weeks ago, on April 11th, just 2 weeks after Barry met with Pope Francis at the Vatican, the Pope characterized abortion as, quote, an unspeakable crime, unquote. So, the Pope mentions abortion as a crime. What does Barry do? Barry sends the following people to be the official delegation representing the American government at the big canonization festivities there in Vatican City. Yes, Barry sent John Podesta, former White House chief of staff under Bubba Bill Jeff Clinton, and current counselor to the president who founded the leftist Washington-based think tank Center for American Progress. That was the headliner there. And then Barry sent a couple others over there with John. Representative Javier Becerra of California, chairman of the House Democrat Caucus. And he also sent Katie Bairn Fallon, assistant to the president and director of legislative affairs in the White House. So the funny thing is, well, it's not funny. The annoying thing to Catholics is that all three of these people are vocally pro-abortion. Vocally, publicly, they advocate for the killing of innocent children on a daily basis. And Barry wraps all three up in a package and sends them over there to Vatican City. And what really annoys me is that the Swiss guard didn't stop them at the gate and tell them to stay out. No, they duly sucked up to all the American representatives. Anyway, it's just, you know, I don't know if Barry was trying to make a political statement by sending a bunch of pro-aborts to represent the American government. I just don't think Barry knows anybody who's not a pro-abort. He doesn't have anyone else to send. It's not like he could send a pro-choice cadre from his circle of friends. It just wasn't going to happen. But it would have been cool to see the Swiss guards, you know, with those pikes they have with the axe on the end, you know, leading Podesta out. That would have been worth it. That would have been worth the price of admission right there. All right. More from the politics file. We go now to the Daily Mail from the United Kingdom. There's a minister of parliament in Japan that is apparently very upset that Michelle Obama did not make the recent trip to Tokyo with Barry. And, well, he wrote an article. This fella's name is Kazuyuki Hamada. He's a member of the upper house of Japan's parliament. He's upset that Michelle stayed home while Barry toured Japan. And he claimed on his blog that a marital rift is responsible for the president's solo trip to Tokyo. Mr. and Mrs. Obama, he wrote, have already decided to divorce after he leave office. Is that racist for me to do that with a Japanese politician? Michelle Obama know her husband is cheating on her, and he used a secret service to hide the evidence.
Japanese people don't talk that.
They're not that gruff. See, here in America, we have a very martial view of the Japanese. Okay. They're always very warlike. They're always, you know, after Pearl Harbor and all that, you know, there's some lingering bad feelings.
I don't care.
Going through all that. But anyway,
have fun. So
this... This rant by Kazuyuki Hamada, member of the upper house of Japan's parliament, closely mirrors a story, an ongoing story being reported in the National Enquirer. And we know they've never been written right about anything. The blue dress. Anyway, we certainly hope that the Obama's marriage is not in trouble for the sake of the children's.
I hope this guy's not cheating on his wife.
You hope Barry's not cheating on his wife, yeah.
This is Japanese.
Oh, Mr. Yamada. Hamada.
Yeah.
Oh, so he could be projecting.
Yeah.
It's very common, by the way, for members of the upper house of Japan's parliament to cheat on their wives.
Not just them.
Everybody? Yeah, Japan. It's rough over there in Japan. It's rough for the family. It's rough for morals and family values, all of that. But it's difficult all the way around. It's difficult all the way around. All right, now let's see. That was not serious news. I opened with a series of not serious stories, I guess. But we'll go now into the serious news of the week as we delve into the war file, again, from the Daily Mail over in London. The Citizens Commission on Benghazi is a self-selected group of former top military officers, CIA insiders, and think tankers, whatever that is. Not sure what a think tanker is. I think it's someone who goes to work every day and just sits down and thinks. They work in a think tank. Always thought of a fish tank full of people with very large foreheads. So these think tankers and CIA insiders declared last Tuesday in Washington that a seven-month review of the deadly terrorist attack in Benghazi determined that it could have been prevented if the U.S. hadn't been helping to arm al-Qaeda militants throughout Libya a year earlier. That's right. That's what I said. That's what they said. And these are insiders. One former CIA officer, Claire Lopez, says that the United States switched sides in the war on terror with what we did in Libya, knowingly facilitating the provision of weapons to known al-Qaeda militias and known al-Qaeda figures. The weapons were permitted to enter by our armed forces right there into Libya. Now, the weapons were intended for Gaddafi, but they were allowed by the U.S., to flow into his Islamist opposition. The White House and senior congressional members deliberately and knowingly pursued a policy that provided material support to terrorist organizations in order to topple Muammar Gaddafi, who actually, in fact, had been working closely with the West to actively suppress al-Qaeda. This is according to think tankers, CIA insiders, and former military officers over there at the Citizens Commission on Benghazi. Now, Wayne Simmons, another former CIA officer who participated in the commission's research, says, quote, some look at it as treason, unquote. Yeah, and he says those weapons are now all in Syria. And so we know what's happening in Syria. Well, we don't know what's happening in Syria. It's chaos. It's disastrous. It's terrible what's happening in Syria. He goes on to say, who was this now? I've lost track of who I was talking about here. That's Wayne Simmons, former CIA officer. He says, Gaddafi actually offered to abdicate shortly after the beginning of the rebellion in 2011, but the U.S. ignored his calls for a truce. He says Gaddafi only wanted two conditions to step down. Number one, he wanted permission to keep fighting al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, and the lifting of sanctions against him, his family, and those loyal to him. The Obama administration's unwillingness to help broker a peaceful exit for the Libyan strongman, according to Mr. Simmons, quote, led to extensive loss of life, including four Americans at Benghazi, unquote. Wow. We switched sides in the war on terror? I tend to think that's true. And Democrats have a tendency to do that. Yes, do you remember when Bill Clinton bombed the Christians in order to protect the Muslims over there in Bosnia-Herzegovina and all of that? You remember that? That was back in the 90s. But you might remember, Democrats have a tendency to line up with the Muslims. I don't know what's up with that. And in this case, it appears that at least, well, not tangentially, but it had a direct impact on the Benghazi assault. Wow. It's deeper than what I was thinking it was all about. That's for sure. A lot deeper than anything I was thinking about. All right. Now, finally, from the war file, for all of you supporters of Edward Snowden, U.S. Representative Mike Rogers, a Republican from Michigan, says that the Snowden leaks will cost the U.S. billions and billions of dollars. He says because of the leaks, the Army, the Navy, the Air Force, and the Marines have to rebuild whole aspects of communications and security operations. That's right. And according to the Middle East Media Research Institute, as a result of the Edward Snowden security leaks, Al-Qaeda has changed its communication methods and altered its encryption practices to sidestep NSA surveillance. It's almost as if, I mean, when you see how Barry switched sides in Libya, it's almost as if Barry and Mr. Snowden are working together to undermine our security, and they're both traitors. Welcome back. It's a show where we don't take calls, we don't tolerate sponsors, but we do focus on the events of the week through the lens of original thought. The wreck is going down. That goes out to our friends over in Ukraine and to everyone who's trying to understand what's going on in Ukraine. Try to bring a little bit of clarity. One thing I said as soon as the protesters started burning tires there in Ukraine was in Kiev, was that this is not going to be good for the Jews. And now I have a report from the Sunday Express in the United Kingdom reporting that Sam Pivnik, tattooed with a Nazi death camp prisoner number, now lives in North London. Here's what he says about Ukraine. He says, there is no point in staying there and waiting for trouble for the Jews. He said, don't hope that world Jewry can save you. He said, Jews in Ukraine should leave now. That's Sam Pivnik, who survived Dr. Joseph Mengele, the angel of death. That's his advice. The Sunday Express reports that during the Second World War, the Nazis exterminated nearly 1 million Jewish people in Ukraine, and anti-Semitism resurfaced there after the nation's independence in 1991 with attacks on Jews by right-wing extremists. So I just want to take umbrage with this habit of journalists to report anyone attacking Jews as right-wing. We remember that the Nazis, they were the National Socialists. They were leftists. They were not right-wing. They only became right-wing sometime in the 60s. And now all journalists report anyone who does anything that's morally repugnant as right-wing. Yeah, skinheads, Nazis, they're all right-wing. Well, they're not right-wing. And the anti-Semites in Ukraine are not right-wing either. They're socialists or outright communists or anarchists. And mostly, they just want to get the Jews out and take their stuff. It's not even political. They're thieves and murderers is what they are. All right, so you people in journalism school, would you please stop teaching young, ignorant journalism students that everything morally repugnant is carried out by the right wing? I know why. It's because you hate the right wing and you hate God. God is a right-wing God and you hate him. And so you do everything you can to make him look bad. Yes, I'm talking to you, journalists. You make me sick. Disgusting. we all heard, back to the story. By the way, you all heard about the leaflets that were distributed out in Donetsk, these anti-Jewish leaflets telling the Jews to register with slogans, and swastikas were painted on houses and on a Jewish cemetery in Odessa. Not good for the Jews. Dr. Ephraim Zuroff of the respected Simon Wiesenthal Center suggested that the Donetsk flyers, quote, were an attempt to paint the pro-Russian forces as anti-Semitic. We don't know who came up with these flyers. We know that they were fake. They were not officially associated with anyone. It's probably Satan himself in a basement somewhere, licking his chops. All we do know in Ukraine is that the climate of fear amongst the Jews grows. Whether the flyers were authentic or not, the underlying undercurrent of anti-Semitism is well known in Eastern Europe. And we just pray that they don't take this as yet another opportunity to kill Jews and steal their stuff, which has been done many, many other times throughout history. All right. Pray for the Jews. Pray for the Christians. Pray for everybody in Ukraine. It's terrible. Now, back to the war file. This is from the Daily Beast, which I think is what's left of Newsweek magazine. Is that right? I can't remember. One of those left-wing magazines that folded up. It's like half the staff of the Washington Post that was laid off last year. I don't know. But they report, they have no choice but to report, that a key jihadist leader and longtime member of Al-Qaeda has taken control of a secret training facility set up by U.S. Special Forces on the Libyan coastline. They report that in the summer of 2012, American Green Berets began refurbishing a Libyan military base in order to train Libya's first Western-trained special operations counterterrorism fighter. So here are the Americans. We go over there with the best of intentions. Our Green Berets go over there to try to set up a camp to teach these Muslims how to root out terrorists. Now that right there is a pretty tall order. Trying to train wild-eyed Muslim fanatics raised in a culture of death to root out terrorists. But there we go, and we build them a brand new shiny military base so that they can train. Well, that base is now under the command of Ibrahim Ali Abu Bakr Tantush. Did you get that? It's Ibrahim Ali Abu Bakr Tantush. Yes, he's a veteran associate of Osama bin Laden, officially designated as part of Al-Qaeda back in 2002 by the United States and the United Nations, a well-known terrorist, now controls the base that was built by the American Green Berets to help root out terrorists. I mean, more than just being an embarrassing foreign policy or defense failure, which this is, utterly, it really does belie not just a level of incompetence when it comes to the Middle East with the Obama administration and the proctocracy that he has hired to administer our defense policy. It really shows me that this guy is totally okay with being on the wrong side, on the other side. Like, he's against us, in my humble opinion. Of course, I don't want to get audited by the IRS. So this is just my opinion. Tantush, this well-known terrorist, gave an interview on Libyan television where he confirmed that he was in Libya, but he would not say that he was in charge of the camp. This guy's obviously a better strategic thinker than Barack Obama or John Kerry or Hillary Clinton or any of the rest. And, well, that's not going to end well. Well, it already hasn't ended well in Libya, and it's just going to get worse, I think. All right, now let's go. We'll move away from the war because that gets depressing. It gets depressing to realize how much things have changed in the last, well, if you just go back to 2000, I was talking about in sixth grade when we all had to do the math to figure out how old we were going to be when the calendar turned to 2000. It's just so bizarre how much things have changed just since the year 2000. It's as if the entire world order has been stood up on its head, and the good guys have become evil, and the evil guys have become guys that we're kind of looking at going, well, maybe they're not as bad as our guys anymore. Maybe. It's just all very depressing to see the decline and fall of America, frankly. And right at the vanguard of that is Hillary Rodham Clinton. Yes. So we go to the Bad Religion file from the Associated Press, where we have Hillary Rodham Clinton going on and on about her faith in God. That's right. She gave a speech and talked about her faith in God. She says her faith in God was shaped by her grandmother's hymns and the bedtime prayers of her Navy father. She struggled as a young woman between her father's insistence on self-reliance, her mother's concern for compassion, and she reconciled the story. So nowhere, now she's going to mention the Bible. Finally, she gets to the Bible in the development of her faith in God. And when she gets to the Bible, here's what she says. She reconciled the struggle between her father's insistence on self-reliance and her mother's concern for compassion. She reconciled her struggle with those two seemingly opposing views with the story of Jesus instructing his disciples to feed the 5,000 people. Yes! Here's what Hillary said in a speech in front of God and everybody with a straight face. She said the disciples came to Jesus and suggest that they send the people away to find food, to fend for themselves. But Jesus said, no, you feed them. He was teaching a lesson about the responsibility we all share.
The devil says.
She said in a in a speech. Where was she giving the speech? We'll get to that. It doesn't really matter. Hillary. Jesus was not teaching a lesson about the responsibility we all share as socialists. Jesus was not giving an example of good communist government, Hillary. He was giving an undeniable, miraculous sign to the Jews that would upset the order of the wicked ruling class, both religious and political. That's what he was doing, Hillary. He was not setting you up to be a communist leader and make you feel better about yourself. Let's see. The AP reports that Hillary's speech mostly steered clear of politics. How can they say that after this? She just used the feeding of the 5,000 as a justification for socialism, for crying out loud. And then the AP to them, she's really steered clear. Another example of you journalism professors and the destruction you have wrought within the reporting class. Well, the speech mostly steered clear of politics, and she made the case on moral grounds for increasing the minimum wage and equalizing pay for men and women. It's not political. It's moral, you see. She quoted Jesus. You know? Yeah. All right. The speech was made at the Quadrennial United Methodist Women's Assembly. Yes, that's right. They say approximately 7,000 United Methodist women, and they're not going to count, they're not going to divide up how many were transgendered, because at the United Methodist Church, if you say you're a woman, you're a woman. Doesn't matter. If you show up in a dress, that's fine. You're counted as one of the 7,000 women at the Quadrennial United Methodist Women's Assembly, where Hillary made her speech. She went on to talk about the church she attended growing up in Illinois. She said, I love that church. I love how it made me feel about myself. Unquote. Perfect description of how the United Methodist Church works. They'll make you feel good about yourself. And Hillary is right out of the mold of the classic United Methodist woman, transgendered or otherwise. She says, she goes on, I got more parts of the speech here. She says, the truth is there are too many women in our country today trying to build a life and a family that don't just face ceilings on their aspirations and opportunities. It's as if the floor is collapsing beneath them. Unquote. That's Hillary's view of being a woman in America. Not only are you going to hit the ceiling, but the floor's coming out from under you. Is she some kind of self-hating United Methodist tranny or what? What's up with Hillary? Don't think we can sit back and wait for someone else to step forward and solve these problems, said Hillary. Okay, well, there you have it. From the bad religion file, Hillary Clinton and the United Methodist Church. Two peas in a pod. They're in the bad religion file. They often occupy quite a bit of space in the bad religion file. Now, speaking of transgendered, self-hating women, let's go to the culture file from the Daily Mail in London. Three lesbians in Massachusetts are sort of married. They're joined together in a marriage-style relationship. Yes. Let's see, they were joined in a marriage-style ceremony last year, and they are now expecting a daughter. The Daily Mail reports that the trio eventually plan to have three children, one for each of them. One for each of them. I don't understand what that means.
We have three kids.
It's like getting three puppies.
We have three kids.
Yes, we do.
All three are
both of ours, I thought. Yeah. Anyway, this is a different kind of relationship. Let's see, they were married in a ceremony in August 2013 when each of their fathers walked them down the aisle. How disgusting is that? That not one of these three women's fathers would stop and say, what the hell are you talking about? You're marrying two women. I'm not going to that. But hey, that's not where we are in America today. The fathers can't even stand up and recognize. All three of the women wore white wedding gowns as if to acknowledge their mental illness and that they still wanted to be involved in something that looked like a real marriage. They exchanged rings. The threesome are equally married to each other as equally married to each other as legally possible, which isn't legally possible. But hey, these journalists, they report this stuff as if it's true. The trio do plan on homeschooling their children. That's right. You can't make this up. Actually, this is nothing to laugh at. This is flat out child abuse. One of the dykes says that through homeschooling, I think we can also educate our kids to have the same strengths that we have. The three of us have been brave. We've stood tall against what society calls normal. I hope our kids will feel free to do the same thing, to stand up against what is normal. So these women should be arrested. I mean, when this publicly gets out that this is what they plan to do to their kids, they should be arrested. Not to mention for the polygamy and the rest of it, for crying out loud. Homosexuality, they should be arrested. The three dykes claim that they are faithful to each other and that they don't plan on adding anyone else to their troop. What do they call it? A throuple? Trouple. I don't know. They made up the word just like they made up this wedding. Thank you for one of the most sophisticated bass lines in all of rock and roll history. You ever listen to that bass line? Just focus on the bass line next time. It's incredibly complex. Yeah. Exactly. It's as complex as the drum lines in any Dawkins song. Now, there is a cryptic reference that virtually no one in the audience will recognize. But you know what? Hey, this is really all about us having fun. That's right. It's like our three kids are both ours. The show is ours. And if you don't get it, well, you just don't get. Some things you just don't get. All right. So, yeah, they made up this word for these lesbians who were married. The reporter calls them a throuple. A thruple. I get it. With a THR. A thruple instead of a couple. A thruple. So one thing, at least this journalism student is somewhat creative and witty, but it's disgusting, nevertheless. All right. So we're going to leave aside the lesbians and the decline and fall of Western civilization and move on, because we do have serious and disturbing news from the Personhood File. You remember the story about a month ago, we reported it here at the Weekly Worldview that the British Health Service had documented at least 15,000 murdered children who were found to have been incinerated to provide heat to hospitals in the Queen's health system there. That's right. They were, along with other medical waste, the bodies of these murdered children were incinerated over there in England. And, of course, it was shocking. The story went around the world. We were shocked and disgusted here, of course. Well, LifeSite News reported this past week that biomedical waste shipped from British Columbia to the United States. British Columbia, by the way, if you matriculated in the government schools or if you graduated from CU, British Columbia is like the western side of, like, Canada, okay? Biomedical waste shipped from British Columbia to the U.S. to be incinerated includes human tissue, more specifically, fetal tissue, even more specifically, the bodies of murdered children shipped down to Oregon to be a part of a to be a part of a green program to provide heat to the hospitals there in Oregon. The British Columbian Health Ministry understands that some of this medical waste was transferred to Oregon, where it was incinerated in a waste-to-energy plant. And this is really not that new. This has been going on for a number of years up there in Oregon. And, you know, the more we find out, the more we decide to look at things, the more we'll probably find out that the parts of the murdered children that they don't sell or do experiments on, they just package it up with other waste and send it off to some feel-good green program. Hey, we're turning medical waste into heat for the hospital. Sounds like a great idea, and it is a fine idea. But apparently they keep meticulous records, and we find out that the bodies of murdered people are being used to heat our hospitals. A 2007 article about the Oregon waste-to-energy facility that appeared in a Willamette newspaper. That was back when the Greenies were announcing this wonderful green program to heat the hospital with medical waste. The Willamette newspaper article announcing this new green feel-good program was ironically entitled Burn Baby Burn. Oh. And this is before they knew. They really didn't know at the time that they were going to be incinerating human bodies of innocent murder victims to heat their hospitals. Anyway, you can't outrun the truth. The truth will find you out. All right. Very disgusting, disturbing story. So we go from that to reason number 714 to get or keep your daughter out of the government schools, or your son. This is from the New York Daily News. From a Connecticut high school, last Friday, Chris Plankson asked Marin Sanchez, 16-year-old young lady, asked her to the prom. Well, she refused. So Chris Plankson shoved her down a flight of stairs, tried to choke her inside Jonathan Law High School, Milford, Connecticut. He then brandished a kitchen knife and stabbed her in the neck. Emergency workers rushed her to the hospital, where she was pronounced dead. Marin Sanchez, 16-year-old girl who died, was an honor student who was active in several after-school programs. Her accused killer also had a respected reputation in the high school. Friends said that he was smart and he did well in class. One friend said of the murderer, the alleged murderer, Chris Plankson, quote, something had to snap, unquote. 16 years old, doesn't want to go to the prom. This whole prom thing, I don't like any of it. I'm glad my daughters don't go to school, and I'm glad that they're not approached to go to dances or dates or anything like that. I think it's unhealthy behavior. I know, I'm a freak. Everyone thinks I'm a freak. Well, you can have it, okay? And I know not every girl who turns down a guy for the prom gets stabbed in the neck and murdered. But every young person who engages in serial dating and experiences serial rejection, every young person is injured by that. And then when they do go to the prom and they end up, it's just not healthy. I'm sorry. And we will not be participating this year or any year in the prom or government schools, frankly. All right. Now, I was struggling with whether or not I should put this next story in the bad religion file or count it as reason number 715. So we're going to do both. This is reason 715 to keep or get your children out of the government schools. A Cypress, Texas government school teacher is being accused of telling an elementary school student she can't read the Bible in school and told the student that she's not even allowed to bring the Bible to school, which makes perfect sense. Why would one of the priests in the Temple of Molech allow a child to bring a Bible? And why would any parent or child assume when you send your kid to a government institution that is going to teach them that there is no God, they happen by mistake, they can have sex like animals, there is no absolute right and wrong. Why would anyone assume that you'd be allowed to bring a Bible there? Well, this student brought a Bible and was reading the Bible and was told, not only can you not read it, you can't even bring it here. What are you thinking about, young lady? Well, parents told a local news outlet that they are outraged that this godless heathen institution would have a problem with their children bringing a Bible. One parent said, well, if it were a time when a child could have silent time or read whatever she wants to read during that time period, she should be able to read whatever she wants to read, even if it's the Bible, said one hapless moronic parent as she shuttled her kid off to be condemned and corrupted in this vile institution. Another parent said, my family and I are devout Christians, and my son has actually brought his Bible to school, and he's in second grade, and I'm going to ask him what's going on. I'm going to ask him what's up. I'm going to find out what's going on here. Tell my boy can't bring his Bible to school. It's outrageous. Idiots. You send your kids to a godless institution that stands four square against everything good that's in the Bible. And then you're shocked that these heathens are upset. It's like bringing holy water to a Satanist convention, for crying out loud. These parents, how could you possibly send your kids to... I can't even comprehend it. I'm sorry. The parents of the student at the center of this particular hullabaloo, they say they do not want to go public for fear of retaliation. So maybe they would get the clue after this. Okay, your daughter is told she can't read her Bible. She's told she can't even bring a Bible. You're upset about that, but you're afraid to go public because of fear of retaliation at the institution where you're sending your kid. Maybe have you seen a red flag yet? Huh? Has a light gone off yet, Mom, Dad? Please, get out. Welcome back, folks. All right, Billy, put those guitars away. Got to get back to the show. But we do appreciate it. All right. Thank you very much, Billy. All right. Now we move on away from the government school controversy. There's no controversy here at the McBurney compound. We just don't participate. And we encourage you not to as well. This is from the Everyone Really Wants to Talk About Religion All the Time file. Yes, I know you've been told religion, politics, things you shouldn't talk about. But really, everybody wants to talk about religion all the time. And this is really proof of it. It's an axiom that I'm developing. Yes. You'd be surprised at how many conversations the undertone is religious, or it's about death, dying, where did we come from, where are we going. That's all religion, and that's all everybody wants to talk about almost all the time. Maybe I'll revise the axiom. Everyone really wants to talk about religion almost all the time. Well, that's kind of a long title for an axiom. It needs to be a lot shorter. Well, we'll be working on that. But this is from that file, is what I'm saying. A report here from Shaft Plant. I have no idea what this website is, but it's about it's some kind of survivalist type thing. And we've got a scientist here who says, I think human implants of RFID receivers, transmitters, are likely to become not optional in the not-too-distant future. And the reporter here says, well, your initial reaction to this idea may be one of disbelief. Well, there's no way society would accept such a device. Well, what type of device are we talking about? We're talking about implantable radio frequency identification chips, more commonly known as the Mark of the Beast. That's right. They're going to become not optional. And he goes on to say that for decades, Americans rejected the notion that they would submit to being tracked or recorded. Yet just about every American now carries a mobile phone. And he says, chances are you're carrying a couple of RFID microchips right now. And if you are, they're constantly sending out a 15-digit number that identifies you. And that number can be picked up by ISO-compliant scanners, and these scanners are everywhere, he says. So we've already got our mobile phones so that, I don't know, Big Brother, I guess, can check where we are at any given moment in time. And you know, he says, this is a scientist. Is this a scientist or is this just a reporter? I got to figure out. Anyway. He says, embedded in every one of these smartphones is an RFID chip that can track our every movement via GPS or cell tower triangulation. The microphones and cameras that are on your phone can be remotely activated by law enforcement surveillance systems. He says, they are accepted as the norm by billions of people worldwide, and nobody had to force smartphones on us. Nobody had to force us to get a smartphone, right? We all went out and bought one. In fact, we line up to get the latest one. He says, we pay top dollar to have the best tracking device that money can buy. And so, basically, I can't get into all the minutia, but basically, all the technology in your smartphone, they can now put it in a tablet the size of a multivitamin pill and put it right under your skin. And eventually, that's what we're all going to want. Because then we wouldn't have to carry a phone, and I'm thinking, I'm okay with that. Yeah, implant a microphone in my lip, a speaker in my ear, and whatever. Yeah, I don't have to carry a phone around.
Well, then maybe I carry it.
I'm cool with that.
I don't care.
Oh, yeah, by the time I get my implant, my extremely attractive audio engineer will be acquiring her first smartphone.
No. Then I will
carry a phone. Oh, I see. It's the whole phone thing. Yeah. If you didn't have to carry a phone around, you might get wired. Okay, well, we'll see. We'll be in line to be the first one to get the implants. Anyway, this fearmonger, he calls this the human microchip, the mark. Human microchip implants will become not optional. And then after describing all this technology that we all voluntarily buy, he says, imagine what a tyrannical government could do with this kind of technology. We don't have to imagine what a tyrannical government would do. We don't have to imagine it. We see it. We're living it right now. But the thing on the other side of the coin, now, of course, We don't want the government, you know, turning on our cell phone camera while we're at home and minding our own business. Nobody would want that. So, I mean, but believe me, I don't think you're that interesting. That if you're listening to the show, you're probably not that interesting that they're going to turn on your camera and your microphone. And if you think they are, you're probably a little bit full of yourself. Now, on the other side, now let's put aside this idea of the mark of the beast and the tyrannical government and all that stuff. But imagine what a godly civilization could do with such technology. To have access to the whole of human thought and knowledge at any given time, all the time. And the ability to know where each one of us are in space at any given time. I mean, if a good government and a good society could do great and wonderful things with this technology. And so I don't think we need to look at this as a mark of the beast, number one. And if you bought a cell phone, don't start worrying that you've already taken the mark. God is not going to condemn anyone to eternal damnation for making a choice to buy technology or receive technology or even to buy and sell. He's not going to condemn anyone to. The mark of the beast, as you know, my theory, is not it's not anything physical. It's a mindset, I believe. But anyway, I'm all for the implant. Sign me up first. Let me go to the head of the line. I don't like carrying around this big old clunky phone, frankly. Drop it, crack it, break it. It's a pain. If they could just implant it all, I think I'm up for it. And I don't think I'd be taking the mark of the beast. All right. More from the Everyone Really Wants to Talk About Religion Almost All the Time file. Fox Television. You remember Fox Television, right? They brought you Married with Children. Do we remember that?
Yeah, yeah.
That was one of the first signs in my short life that surely all of Western civilization was coming to an end soon, was Married with Children, that show. In fact, the Fox Network in general was a huge red flag along the highway to hell for me, for America. It's one of the things that told me we're in trouble. Well, Fox is developing an event series about Jesus' formative years. Yes. Deadline.com, which is a Hollywood-type rag, reports that with the popularity of Bible-themed projects showing no signs of subsiding, Fox has put in development a show called Nazareth. And it's not the band from the 70s. It's about Jesus in his teenage years. It follows the formative years of Jesus of Nazareth. Between the ages of 13, following his pilgrimage to Jerusalem, to the age of 30, when he began his ministry. Yeah, yes, and not only that, Lifetime Television, in February, started development on a TV show called The One, which is also described as a coming-of-age story exploring Jesus' early life and formative years, giving more credence to my axiom that almost everyone wants to talk about religion almost all the time. And I think that's what I'll stick with as far as that axiom. Almost everyone wants to talk about religion almost all the time. Even the folks, the degenerates at Fox, they want to talk, they wonder, what did Jesus do in those years between, what's that all about? They're actually interested in it because people are interested in religion and God and the Bible and history and the universe and where we came from and where we're going. They're actually almost obsessed with it. Almost. The whole world is almost obsessed with it because there are all these giant questions that are under in the background of just about every conversation we all have about life and living, right and wrong, and death and dying and all that. And almost everyone wants to talk about religion. Almost all the time. All right. Now, let's see here. I wanted to... I don't care about that. The science. I think I'll save this. I may do a show with Bob. He's a little under the weather this week. Bob Enyart here on Christian Radio. I may sit in for him this week or with him, and so maybe I'll save these stories. This thing about editing DNA is just fascinating. I can't resist. This is from the Independent over in London. From the Science Really file, a genetic disease has been cured in living adult animals for the first time using a revolutionary genome editing technique that can make the smallest changes to the vast database of the DNA molecule with pinpoint accuracy. This is amazing. Scientists have used the genomic editing technology to cure adult lab mice of an inherited liver disease by correcting a single letter of the genetic alphabet, which had been mutated. Wow. A similar mutation in the same gene causes the equivalent inherited liver disease in humans. So this is pretty substantial. Editing the DNA, right? So you think, wow, the future is incredibly bright. But then you pick up this story about Puerto Rico. Puerto Rico, like just about everywhere else in the world, their government is in a financial crisis. 45% of the population lives in poverty. The unemployment rate is 15%. And Puerto Rico's debt crisis seems to be reaching a day of reckoning. This is according to Fusion.com, a website that talks about such things. Well, the government down there in Puerto Rico has started accepting suggestions on what to do about the financial crisis. So here are some of the ideas that the government has accepted and decided that they're going to take under consideration. Number one, legalize and tax marijuana. Number two, legalize and regulate prostitution and sex work.
Okay. Isn't that legal there?
I'm surprised it's not legal there yet. So, I mean, we go from one story where we've got scientists editing DNA to cure diseases, and we've got the proctocracy in Puerto Rico thinking they can legalize drugs and prostitution to take care of our money problems. So, I mean, the future looks bright. The future looks dismal. Which side do you think carries the day? At this point, I think it's the dopers and the hookers, frankly, and not the scientists editing DNA. Unfortunately. Meanwhile, we have to go to Russia for the politics file. Did I make my point on that? Oh, I know. It was the juxtaposition of the editing of the DNA and the legalizing prostitution. Well, that was the main thing. But I have a suggestion for the Puerto Rican proctocracy. Okay? My two ideas to help solve your debt crisis. Number one, cut the government to its just functions, infrastructure, justice, and defense. That's number one. And two, let the people live at liberty within the bounds of Christian charity. And your whole problem solves itself in a couple of years. But I would not be considering legalizing drugs and prostitution. I think
it's not working.
Yeah, come over to Colorado. Anyway, it's not going to work. It's going to end badly there for the proctors of Puerto Rico. But we go to Russia, where the Russian parliament's lower house has passed a bill that bans swearing. Yes, profanity, vulgarity, utterances like that. The bill bans swearing from films, music, and other works of art. Yes. Now, the bill says, now it's only passed in their lower house. It's got to go through the upper house. And then Pope Vlad will sign off on it as he tries to position his country as the great Christian savior of Western civilization. The bill says a panel of experts will decide exactly what counts as a swear word. That'll be Vladimir Putin. Now, another law restricting the use of profanities in the media came into force in Russia in April 2013, so this isn't the first time they've done this. Now, this new bill would impose, they're going to impose fines for swearing. Okay, so that means they're not really serious about it. And that Vlad and the other, the guys with the funny hats in the Orthodox Church there, yeah, come on, guys. Anyway, they're going to collect fines for swearing, and public officials would have to pay double if they swear. Yeah. The former law from 2013 has fines up to 200,000 rubles. I think that's like $6 that you could get fined for swearing. Finally, from the justice file, ladies and gentlemen, Jeffrey Chapman is accused of the murder of Damon Gaylert in 2011 in Kansas, and he's about to go on trial, but he's worried that his tattoo may have a negative impact on the trial. His lawyer says Mr. Chapman's tattoos are not relevant to any material facts, and Mr. Chapman asks for the court to exclude any mention of his tattoos at the trial, and further, to be allowed to cover up his tattoos in an appropriate manner. Yes. Jeffrey Chapman has the word murder tattooed across his neck. And, of course, his lawyer insists that that's irrelevant. Well, that's irrelevant to the state's case, and it could be extremely prejudicial to Mr. Chapman if introduced at trial or observed by the jury. So the lawyer is, he's trying to persuade the court to actually send the murderer out to have the word murder removed from his neck. And right now the judge apparently is it's just unbelievable. Say again? Yes, prejudicial, perhaps. By the way, Damon Gaylert's body was found by a roadside ditch in November of 2011. Lost in all this is that there was an innocent man murdered by this man who has the word murder tattooed on his neck. That's the justice system in America today. And the fact that lawyers are even allowed to argue this kind of stuff tells you that we're far and away down that slippery slope on the road to hell. But this is the Weekly Worldview, and I want to thank my friends at Denver Bible Church and American Right to Life, and of course my other brother Daryl, who makes it all happen here at the Weekly Worldview Studios. Should the Lord tarry, I will return next week, and until then, may the grace of God go with you, and may the peace of Jesus Christ be upon you.